You're listening to the Sex and Psychology Podcast, the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Lehmiller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. There's a famous scene in the Comedy Central series Broad City where the character of Abby is on a date with a guy who hands her a strap-on dildo and eagerly assumes the position. He wants to get pegged. Abby has a minor freak out and runs to the bathroom to phone a friend for advice, but she ultimately agrees to do it. And everyone is happy about it, until Abby accidentally ruins her date's dildo by running it through the dishwasher and replacing it with a cheap substitute. Scenes like this, in which a woman anally penetrates her male partner, have become increasingly popular in both porn and pop culture in recent years. So why is that? What's behind the pegging trend? We're going to talk about that in today's show. This episode is a continuation of the previous show in which we discussed the ins and outs of anal sex. Today, we're going to dive further into the subject by exploring the popularity of pegging, the role of the prostate in sexual pleasure, tips for using sex toys during anal play, as well as what you need to know when it comes to topics like douching and finding the right lube. I am joined once again by Dr. Thomas Gaither, a physician who is currently finishing up his urology residency at UCLA. In addition to conducting research on LGBT health and sexual medicine, he is an active TikTok creator teaching the masses about sexual health. You can find him on TikTok at ThatProstateDoc. I can't wait for this conversation. Stick around and we're going to jump in right after the break. In today's increasingly digital world, it's more important than ever to understand the intersection between sex and technology, and also to preserve our rights and privacy. For a deep dive into these issues and more, attend this year's Securing Sexuality Conference, which will be held October 19th and 20th in Detroit, Michigan. This event will bring together hundreds of sex therapists, IT security professionals, medical providers, researchers, and advocates. Securing Sexuality is the premier conference for people who are passionate about promoting sex-positive, science-based, and secure interpersonal relationships. Attendees will come away with a deeper understanding of and appreciation for the challenges and solutions to building healthy relationships against the backdrop of emerging technologies, while also cultivating a meaningful global community of colleagues. Continuing education credits are available for qualified professionals. Check the show notes for the link or purchase your pass to the Securing Sexuality Conference today at securingsexuality.com. That's securingsexuality.com. Many of us aren't comfortable talking about sex in general, including with our own partners. This is why it's really important to learn how to build up your sexual communication skills and expand your sexual knowledge base. And that's why I recommend checking out Beducated, a revolutionary form of online sex education. They have an extensive library of courses you can take in the comfort of your own home, designed to give you the sex ed you never got before so that you can communicate more effectively, develop deeper connections, and experience more pleasure. Try all of their courses today for free, and if you like what you see, you can get 40% off the yearly pass by using my last name, Lehmiller, as the coupon code. There's also a 14-day money-back guarantee. Check the show notes for the link and be sure to use my last name to get your discount. Enjoy. Okay, Tom, let's talk about butt stuff. So in the last episode, we discussed a lot of the reasons why people have anal sex, and pleasure is way up there on the list. But I wanted to ask you for a little bit more information on why this activity is pleasurable for many people. Now, you've done a bit of research on the role of the prostate, and I know you alluded to this in the previous episode that the prostate isn't always a pleasure source, particularly if it becomes enlarged, but for a lot of people, it is. So tell us a little bit about how and why prostate stimulation can be a big part of anal pleasure.
Yeah, well, I think people know that when you go to the doctor and you need to get your prostate checked, the way that we access the prostate is through the rectum. So the prostate is about 2 to 3 inches inside the rectum, and it's a gland. It's a gland that sits right underneath the bladder, and it helps to create sort of the juices, right? The seminal fluid that is in ejaculate. And what's interesting about the prostate is that there's a whole bunch of sensory nerves that kind of wrap around the prostate that can give people pleasurable sensations during receptive anal intercourse. The reason why I think it's just in the right location for receptive anal intercourse to kind of take advantage of it. And many people find stimulation to that area around the prostate very pleasurable.
Yeah. And I actually saw some research recently. I think it came out of Barry Komisarek's lab where, you know, they do this mapping of where in the brain different forms of genital stimulation are being registered. And what they found in their research on women is that stimulation of the nipple, the vagina, the clitoris, and the cervix all activate what's known as the genital sensory cortex. And that's part of the reason why some women might experience nipple orgasms is because it's activating the same area of the brain as genital stimulation. It's also why some women have a cervical orgasm. Some women actually enjoy cervical stimulation. And in terms of the work that they've done on men, they find that the prostate stimulates the same region of the brain where the penis registers sensation in the male genital sensory cortex. So, you know, there's something to that. You know, they're feeding through these common neural pathways, going to the same parts of the brain. So it makes sense that it would be pleasurable to a lot of people.
I think the other thing, one comment on that is too, is that the base of the erectile bodies pass kind of near the prostate as well. They kind of dive in and form this sort of downward cross and going out. And so a lot of people said that, you know, during receptive anal intercourse around the near the area of the prostate, they also felt like good sensations in the penis as well. So not only I think is it probably neurally connected, like you said, but it's probably also just very proximally connected anatomically all in that area.
Yeah, all these things are in the same area. So you're kind of stimulating more than one thing at the same time. I guess the exception to that would be the nipple, since that's a little bit further away. But I believe there was also a study out of Komisarek's lab where they found that in men, stimulation of the nipple also activates the genital sensory cortex, which might be why some men find nipple stimulation to be particularly pleasurable. Personally, I don't. My nipples, for whatever reason, they're a dead zone. You know, you can do whatever you want to them. I'm just not going to feel anything. But, you know.
That's fascinating. The idea of erogenous zones are just so interesting, and like, how do they develop, right? And why is it for some people really enjoy nipple stimulation, other people do not? Like, you could tug on them all day and there's just nothing registering upstairs, where, you know, some people are their neck or their ears, like the extra genital erogenous zones are very interesting. But I think it also applies to bottoming, because people enjoy sort of different areas being stimulated. And what's really interesting to me is that not everyone is the same.
Yeah. And what is pleasurable about anal sex receptively to, you know, across persons varies a lot. Some people, it's more about that sensation of feeling stretched or kind of like distended. For other people, it might be that stimulation of the prostate. There are different things that people might enjoy about it. Some people might like it hard and fast. Some people might like it slow and gentle. It's just, everybody's different, which is why I think it's important not to get too hung up on this idea of having like a sex move that you apply to every partner in your life, because mm-hmm. it's not going to work out the same way with every single partner. Now, of course, not everyone who engages in receptive anal intercourse has a prostate, but they might still find the activity to be pleasurable. So can you tell us a little bit about why, for example, a cis heterosexual woman who does not have a prostate might find this activity to be pleasurable?
I think it's so much to do with sort of the anatomy of the muscles around the anus and the rectum. So there's a just like as you can stretch any muscle in your body and say, oh, that kind of feels good. The anal sphincter muscles can be stretched. The pelvic floor muscles can be stretched. And, you know, both men and women have the same set of muscles that people find pleasurable when stretched. Now, also for, you know, cis women, there's also the clitoris, and the clitoris does sort of dive deep just like the penis does. It's a homologous structure to the penis. And so I think some women also report that that sort of sensation can get kind of poked and prodded, but from the backside. And I think that's why they also find it can be pleasurable.
Yeah. And the rectum also shares a wall with the vagina. And so that might provide another form of stimulation. So yeah, it's not all about the prostate. There can be a lot of different reasons why people find receptive anal sex to be pleasurable. So in our discussion of anal sex so far, we focused more on penile anal insertion, but that's obviously not the only way that people might practice anal sex. Toys and strap-ons are increasingly a big part of that, which brings us to the topic of pegging. So can you define what pegging is for my audience? And do you have any sense of how common this practice might be?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, pegging, gosh, there's probably 1,000 different definitions of it. But in general, it is when somebody uses like a strap-on dildo or some sort of phallic structure, and they use that for penetration. And it can be between two women. It can be between a woman pegging a man, the woman being the insertive partner, the man being the receptive partner. And it can also be between two men, should that's what they want to do. You know, I can't say I have a whole lot of data on how common this is, but I have to say, as I put my name out there and put out my TikTok, you know, one of the main people who've reached out to me more than anything are straight men who are interested in getting involved with this practice and wanting to know how to safely do it. So I have been sort of pleasantly surprised. It's not something that I was necessarily expecting, but now in retrospect, I'm like, of course, you know, they again, receptive anal intercourse it's a behavior. It's not a sexual orientation. So.
Yeah. And I'm not aware of any great data on the prevalence of it. You know, I think when people hear the term pegging, they're most likely to think about it in the context of a woman who is anally penetrating her male partner with a strap on. But yeah, as you mentioned, it can take different forms. But in terms of some of the data that I have on sexual fantasies, I asked people, you know, how often they fantasize about receptive anal intercourse. And in this survey of more than 4,000 American adults that I conducted, I found that almost 60% of men had fantasized about it before, and the sample was predominantly heterosexual. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of straight guys who fantasize about receptive anal sex. But I think so many of them feel a lot of shame and anxiety about it. Like, does this make me gay if I'm into being anally penetrated? And no, it doesn't. Like, as you mentioned, it doesn't say anything about your sexual orientation. But I think it's not surprising to me that you have a lot of straight guys who reach out to you, because I see in my own data, a lot of guys like really seem to be into this, but they just don't know who to talk to about it. They don't feel like they can talk about it with their buds, you know, over a beer at the sports bar.
This reminds me of a story of when we were searching for participants for our very, very first study. We really wanted to find a straight guy who was into pegging, just so we could say, hey, does the sensations that you feel the same as these other gay guys over here sort of thing? And we finally found a guy, and he was so open and honest about it. And, you know, when he was first starting to enjoy the sensations of pegging with women, he talked about this idea of like, this questioning about himself. He's like, am I gay? Is this, you know, and he's very sexually fluid open. So he was like, you know what? I'm going to have a sex with a man just to see if I like it. And he was like, this is not it. It's not that I don't like men. He was like, they're gross. They're nasty. They're hairy. It's not for me. He's like, but I just like the way that this makes me feel. This sort of intimacy that he had with women. So it was really interesting to hear him talk about his story very openly and his sort of thoughts of homosexuality, but it really was something completely different.
That's fascinating. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because it actually leads very nicely into my next question. I mean, I was going to ask, what do you think the appeal of pegging is to so many heterosexual guys? And are there reasons for this similar or different to those of gay men? You know, and I think, as you mentioned, you know, it might be that sensation that they're experiencing, that where there's this commonality. I wonder if there might also be some differences, for example, where for some there might be kind of a power play element, because you're flipping the traditional heterosexual power dynamic on its head in bed by having the woman as the insertive partner. I think there could also be sort of just a general novelty element, or maybe it's just really taboo because there are so many taboos around men and anal exploration. So yeah, I don't know if you have any further thoughts on that, but I think there are certainly some commonalities in terms of what people get out of anal sex, but some differences as well.
Yeah, it's a great thing. I don't have enough anecdotes or stories as to why, what brought people to it. It could also just be a cultural thing. Like, as it becomes more and more accepted that, you know, all men can use their anus and rectum as a part of their sexual repertoire per se, that more and more people try it and do it in that sense. But I think everything that you mentioned really resonates with what most of what people talk about, you know, control, the idea of novelty, something new, power play, that people like to explore.
Yeah. And this reminds me, I actually wrote an article for Playboy a few years ago. It was titled something like The Peak of Pegging. And it was kind of about how pegging is suddenly everywhere in the popular media. And you see these storylines about it on different TV shows and in movies. And, you know, it's funny as a social psychologist looking at how sexuality is depicted in the media over time, what is taboo is constantly shifting. And, you know, anal sex, anal stimulation was taboo for so long. It still is to some degree, but it's becoming less so. And so it just makes me wonder what the next frontier is going to be in terms of, you know, what are the next taboos that we're going to break on television and in the media? And who knows, but I'll be interested to watch for sure.
Absolutely. Desire is like fueled by taboo. Desire is fueled by mystery. So we will see what the next frontier will be.
Yes. Now, let's say that someone in a relationship wants to explore pegging or other kinds of anal stimulation in the bedroom, and they've never done it before with their partner. They never talked about it before. Do you have any tips you can share on how do you bring this up with a partner? Like, how do you introduce the idea of anal play in a relationship?
This is a great question. And I don't know. I don't know if I have a really great answer, but I think I understand the hesitation that many men may have to bring this up with women. Because again, it's like, is she going to think that I'm gay, you know, or whatever else? But really, when you actually talk to the people about it, most of the women were very excited about this idea that they could also do something different in the bedroom. So I think if people are hesitant, I want you to also just think about maybe that there is another side. Maybe you're not giving your partner sort of enough credit to be able to listen to this. The best thing to do, you know, as I've said before, and as obviously you know, the biggest sexual organ is our brain. You know, 90% of sex is all happens within the brain. So the best thing you can do is just talk about it. You have to say, you know, it's like, hey, I listened to this podcast, or hey, like I, you know, read this article about this. What do you think about this? You know, give them a leeway to talk about what they, you know, have heard or not heard, because there is just so many myths about it that I think it's just not talked about. It is just one way in which to have sex. It's not like you and your partner are going to just be pegging for the rest of your life sort of thing. It's just one tool. And especially people who've been in like sort of long-term monogamous relationships, I think a lot of people in those situations are trying to figure out, how do I maintain desire in my relationship? And how do I keep sex fun and novel? So I think just opening up with the conversation is got to be the first steps for it.
And if you've never really talked about sex or sexual desire before with your partner, maybe not the best idea to just come out and be like, hey, I want you to peg me. You know, that might just be too much. You know, it's kind of like,
yeah.
I get emails from a lot of straight guys who are like, how do I convince my wife to go out and sleep with other men because I think it would be hot. And I'm like, maybe you don't just, well, it's not about convincing them of anything first, right?
Right.
But also it's like, if you've never had a lot of serious conversations about desire, and then you say, hey, let's open our relationship, I want you to sleep with other people, that's just too much too soon. And so I think in a lot of cases, you kind of need to step back, lay the foundation, build up the trust and intimacy, maybe start sharing some of your more vanilla desires, and then you can kind of work up to things over time. I have lots of tips for sharing sexual fantasies, and for anyone who wants more, you can check out my book, Tell Me What You Want, where I talk about this in great detail. Now, in the previous episode, we talked about some tips for exploring anal sex in general if you're a beginner, but how are the tips or considerations different when you're talking about inserting a toy or a strap-on compared to inserting a penis? So in other words, do you need to think any differently about things like safety and pleasure when it comes to using toys instead of a penis?
You know, most people are a lot more comfortable with toys than when it comes to penises. So I remember a lot of people saying, it's like, yeah, anytime I did this by myself, I never had this type of pain. And then when I did it with my partner, it was like all of a sudden painful. And they were always kind of confused by that. So, and it all goes back to speed. It goes back to control. And these are all the things that you can control when you're using a toy. So the one thing you have to be aware of course, is plenty of lube. It should, you have to, again, listen to your body. And then often people have asked, you know, like what type of lube, it has a lot to do with the type of toy that you're using. Like if, you know, silicone-based toys, people say don't use silicone-based lube because it can kind of break down the toy. So people will use water-based lubes in that scenario. But, and also the size. I think that's another thing to talk about in terms of the toy. I've never had any issues with people using anything that was like an electronic, so like sort of battery operated that vibrated. I've never come across issues with that, but I have had issues with people who have put sort of too big of things that they can't get back out. And unfortunately, we've seen a few people in the ER with, you know, dildos that have gotten stuck up there, and there can be some disastrous complications to that. But these are usually people who are putting extremely large things, like 18-inch things, inside of there. So, you know, if you've never done it before, I would definitely, you want to start smaller, then bigger, and sort of work your way up. Dilation sort of thing that you had spoken about before. So it's definitely smaller, I would say, better than bigger at the beginning.
Yeah. And regardless of size, it's a good idea to make sure that it has a flared base, right? Because that's where the real risk comes in for something going in and then becoming irretrievable. And yeah, it turns out that sex toys getting lost inside the anus is actually the single most common sex toy injury that happens. And there are thousands of cases of this that happen throughout the country that send people to the ER. So, you know, just be careful with it. You don't want to insert things too far so that you can't get them out. And then, of course, you also need to think about things like cleaning your sex toys before and after use, you know, making sure that you're maintaining hygiene, cleanliness. Also thinking about things like if you're sharing sex toys, that's a whole different consideration for something like STI acquisition. So, you know, if you're sharing it with a regular partner, that's one thing, but you know, maybe not share with your friends, or maybe wrap it up in a condom, you know, to reduce that risk of STI transmission if you're using shared sex toys. So a few different things to think about there, but just make sure you don't go overly big and make sure you got a flared base. Now, a super common question I get from people with regard to anal sex, whether they're having it with penises or with toys, is whether they should douche beforehand. And we alluded to this a little bit previously, and it seems like this is a common practice, particularly among gay and bisexual men, but not as much for women. I was actually looking at a literature review right before the show that found that only about a third of women who have engaged in receptive anal intercourse say that they douche beforehand, whereas more than two-thirds of men who have sex with men say that they do it. And I'm not entirely sure of what the reasons are for this, but that seems to be a pretty big gender difference. What's your take on anal douching in general? Good idea, bad idea? Best practices. Any thoughts there?
I love this topic. In our data set as well, about 70% of men douched before receptive anal intercourse. And, you know, I think the thing why there is a gender difference, this is a little bit of speculation, but it has a lot to do with how well you know your partner. If you know your partner fairly well, I talked to a few people where they're like, we just don't douche because if there's a little bit of a mess, we're just going to do it a different day. If you are sleeping with people who you don't know, there might be a lot more sort of shame or embarrassment that is kind of more challenging to deal with. And so the sort of gold standard way to clean the rectum out is using an enema or, you know, cleaning out with, you know, tap water or some sort of saline solution. So if you absolutely want to be clean, 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 no, not a freckle of stool, you know, a lot of people will do this. I think it's tough because there is a lot of literature that shows that, you know, douching may put you at risk for STIs because of a disruption of the epithelial barrier. But it's always hard to tease out people who may be douching specifically to hook up, which is a behavior where you're more likely to get an STI than if you're sleeping with somebody who've known for a few months, 2 years, or however long. So there's a lot of confounding there. And I'm not 100% convinced that douching really is the one thing that does it, but there is some suggestion out there that it can put you at higher risk. For me, I think the best thing I can advise people to do is to really have more bulky stools. If you can get like, you know, and taking things like psyllium husk or Metamucil, and if you can get you to form like nice logs, sorry to be so graphic, but if you can get kind of nice logs, generally the rectum doesn't store stool. The rectum, I mean, the sigmoid colon and above really stores the stool. And when that gets full, that sends you a signal to the brain that you need to poop and go and evacuate. And then the rectum is just like the final canal. So in general, the rectum is not really full of a bunch of stool, but it can be if your stool is really watery And that can kind of bring out a bunch of mess. So if you want an alternative to douching, but yet you still want to try to be clean, I think the best thing you can do is sort of titrate or supplement with either psyllium husk or some sort of bulking stool agent to get your stool to be more formed. And that's one thing that people can do to kind of be clean and maybe not have to douche as often. But like I said, the biggest relationship to people who do douche is the type of relationship they have with that partner.
Yeah. It's such an interesting and under-researched topic. You know, there's not a ton of data out there exploring this just in general, because anal sex has long been considered a kind of taboo practice. And, you know, it's kind of hard to get grant funding to study topics like this. Easier to get funding if you're studying something focused specifically on STIs, but less about other sorts of aspects of sex. Some of the stuff that I've read suggests that you can overdouche, and that can be a problem. And the way a lot of people are approaching it is probably that they're overdoing it. Like, you don't need to basically give yourself a, what is it called?
Like a colonoscopy washout.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need to power blast the area and like clean out your entire intestines, right? Because that's the issue. Like, some people put so much water up there that they're going like deep into the intestines. And, you know, that's going to not only create a very long process, like you're going to commit to like a half hour, an hour to clean yourself out, but you don't need to go that far, particularly for the way most people are engaging, because the portion of the colon that you're using for anal sex is not that deep, right? So it's something where there's not a lot of data and research. Different people seem to have different opinions on it, but you probably don't need to do the power washing. And there are lots of things you can do, like you said, with the supplements and fiber and so forth, to make it easier cleanup.
I agree. Sort of the smaller amount of water is probably better. But even in our study, we had people who say, oh yeah, I douche, it takes me 10 minutes. And there are other people, they spend 2 hours trying to clean that out. And that I think we can improve upon. Spending 2 hours to get your rectum ready, I think is a little bit too much, in my opinion. And then the other thing is, we just got to reduce the little bit of shame about a little bit of stool in general. You know, people talked about, you know, it's just the occupational hazard. A person in my study once said, you know, it's just the shitty kitty, you know? And so there's other ways that we can also kind of reduce a little bit of the stigma around that.
Sure. Now, I have another question for you with regard to anal sex, which gets at something we've been talking about. You know, we've talked about using lube, but how do you select the right kind of lube? And this is something you asked people about in your own research. You know, what are people's preferred lubricants? And they're kind of all over the map. Most people selected water or silicone-based lubes, but you had other people who mentioned oil-based, or they use spit or saliva, or moisturizing lotion that they have sitting around. Some people said Crisco, and some people said they prefer not to use any lube at all, right? So people are kind of all over the board there. But as a sexual healthcare provider, what do you want people to know when it comes to lube and anal sex and finding the right lube for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, there's also been a lot of studies, are does certain type of lubes cause more sexually transmitted infection? I mean, I think at the end of the day, you want a lube that, one, you can afford, but two, that it works well for you, that it feels good and, you know, reduces the friction and the pain is okay. And then three, you don't want it to have any sort of negative, harmful effects on your body. And I really haven't found anything in terms of really harmful, negative effects in terms of water-based or silicone-based or even oil-based lubes. I think a lot of them have been shown, or at least anecdotally, are fairly safe. And I don't know of any one that is better than the other. You know, we did do a study a few years back and did show that people who use spit were more likely to get sexually transmitted infections. But then again, you got to also think about who is using spit versus these other things. And maybe there's some confounding factors. So overall, I don't usually recommend spit. It dries out very easily. There's a lot of organisms in the mouth. I typically will recommend either water-based lube or silicone-based lube. And then people can, you know, try out each of them and see which one they like the most. It's interesting because when people first start bottoming, their most preferred lube is water-based lube. And then if you look throughout the years, a lot of people switch over into the silicone-based lube. So I think a lot of my, I would say, gold star bottoms, like the ones that are really doing it a lot, majority of them are using some sort of silicone-based lube.
Yeah. And when it comes to lube, it might take a little bit of experimentation to figure out the one that's right for you. Not all lubes are created equal. One of the complaints some people have with water-based lubes is they just don't last as long, which I think is why, you know, for the pros that you're just talking about, they often switch to something that's a little bit longer lasting. A lot of silicone lubes will have more staying power, if you will. When it comes to something like an oil-based lube, you need to consider, how am I engaging sexually? Oil-based lubes might not be compatible with the condoms that you're using. They might not be compatible with sex toys. So there's lots of different things you kind of need to take into account there. What are your sexual practices, safety, condoms, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's often a little bit of trial and error. And I guess the only other thing I would think about here would be you probably don't want to use the tingling lubes, the warming lubes and things like that for anal sex. Actually, just in general, you might want to be careful with them because they can cause irritation of the genital tissues. So it's something that I think is hard because there's so many lubes on the market. How do you know which one is right for you? And sometimes it just takes a bit of trial and error.
Yeah, I love the trial and error thing. There are so many different types out there. These are all good points.
So much lube. Well, thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Tom. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work?
Well, thank you, Justin. It was a pleasure and an honor to be here. Majority of people can, you know, follow me on TikTok, That Prostate Doctor. And it's also my sort of email as well, thatprostatedoctor@gmail.com. Feel free to email me if you have a research idea or want to be a part of the research. I'd love to hear from you.
That Prostate Doctor. I'll be sure to include the link in the show notes. So thank you again so much for your time. It was great to have you here. And thank you to my listeners. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller and everywhere else. So be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.